Welcome to the Vortex Nation podcast, brought to you by lovers of hunting, shooting, public lands, the Second Amendment, and good food. All right, what is up, everybody? I have Eric Barber to my right. Eric, you're becoming like a little bit more of a common fixture to my right as of late. So I'm enjoying
it. I like this, Mark.
I love Jim. I miss Jim, but it's nice having you around.
Thank you. That's flattering. I did not expect this to start off on such a flattering note, but thank you.
You're welcome. Really, really great topic today. I know that's one that's close to our hearts personally, but I should mention we actually have cameraman Cooper running the podcast gear today.
Yep.
This is close to his heart as well, so I know he'll be tuning in and have his notepad out. We're going to talk all about how to kill more bucks in less time. And to help us do that, across from us, we have the Andy May, the king of killing bucks in less time. I've been on the other... I've been running the other program, killing less bucks in more time. So I'm really, really looking forward to our talk today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm honored that you asked. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely.
What for the listeners out there, and I always, not always, but like to do this, I think painting a picture of your background, how you got into deer hunting, maybe things that you started doing, or just your evolution as a deer hunter really paints a picture of your strategies today. So maybe if you can, talk a little bit about maybe how you got into deer hunting, and we can start there.
Sure. The way I got into hunting is a little unconventional. I didn't come from a hunting family at all. In fact, I did just a little bit of fishing kind of as a kid, even though I was always outside in nature and like catching frogs and stuff like that. I loved that kind of stuff. Got into fishing a little bit, but it wasn't until I was 18 years old. I had a couple of cousins that started bow hunting, and they got into it the year before me, and they kept trying to talk me into bow hunting. So what they started doing in the off season is they get into these archery leagues. So I was like, all right, well, that looks pretty cool. Like, I was always interested in archery. Like, I love the old Robin Hood movies and stuff like that. I just was always thought that was cool. In fact, there was once when I was young, I tried to make my own bow out of my mom's broomstick. Like, I took the bottom out, I started standing it and tried to unsuccessfully make a bow, but I always loved archery. So I ended up getting a bow. And I got in this archery league, and that was before even, you know, setting foot in the woods. And for whatever reason, I was naturally good at it. I actually won the archery league my first year with, you know, and there was probably 50 hardcore hunters in there.
Wow.
So it was just whatever, the eye-hand coordination or whatever, I was just pretty good at it. And everybody was like, man, you should really bow hunt. So the next year is when I took that first step into bow hunting. And, man, it was just... it was just something I fell in love with instantly. I tend to do this with things. I can get singular focused on whatever it is I'm passionate about, and that just took front and center. I mean, it was kind of fishing, and then it switched over to bow hunting, and then that was it. That's all I wanted to learn as much as I could. That's all I wanted to do. And that's kind of how it all started. That first year, I think I shot 2 whitetail does. And then my second year, I shot my first buck. And then my third year, I got invited on a deer drive. And I wasn't much of a gun hunter, but I had bought a shotgun and I sighted it and everything. And I got invited by this family, and they had owned this farm for 30 some years. And they're like, you know, I was the new guy, so they put me like way over here where like no deer were going to, you know, go to, which, you know, that's appropriate, right? I'm the new guy.
Jeez.
Well, anyway. Yep.
Welcome. Welcome. Yeah. Sit over here. This is the gar hole.
Yeah, exactly. Push deer to us. Okay. Yep. So, but ironically, this big buck jumped up and it comes running across the field, and I, you know, took my gun up. I don't know. It was like 80 yards, but he was on a steady, you know, a steady run. And I just tracked the deer and I shot and I dropped him. And it ended up being the biggest buck that has ever been killed off that farm. And I don't want to say it was skill or anything, but what it seems to me that for whatever reason, even early on, I just had a knack for killing things.
Yeah.
You know? And it didn't come, I never went through like what I consider like a real struggle phase. Like when I started off early, no doubt, like I made a ton of mistakes, lots of errors, and the learning was there, but I always seem to find a way to get it done. I think early it was more through just sheer determination and time. Yeah. You know, I just like would be out there from the start of the season to the end of the season. In fact, before I had my daughter, I spent, you know, every second in season or off season that I had in the whitetail woods. And I basically forsake every other hobby. Like fishing took a big nosedive. I used to golf, basically quit. It became everything I thought of, everything I lived for. I spent every, like I said, every second out there. And I think because I did that for so many years, I think it really, it's where it instilled a lot of the knowledge and the tactics and the habits that I have now. As a hunter, it really laid that groundwork that helped me be successful. Mm-hmm. So now it kind of has progressed into, you know, slow progression of like hunting almost every day of the season and scouting 5 or 6 times a week off season has now progressed to, you know, now I have a family and more of a demanding career. I work 2 jobs. Well, now it's like because I had that long stretch of where I put everything into it. And I had that mindset of, I want to learn and I want to be better. I don't want to just hunt. You know, I always had that mindset of like, how do these guys do this? I need to read on this guy. I need to talk to this guy. And then I need to try to implement it. And I tried to just learn as much as I could. And over time, it's progressed to where I can hunt less and have more success because of the things I learned in those early years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I still, to this day, I might spend a lot less time hunting because other priorities, yep. But my success has actually increased, but the time that I spend over a year span is still quite a bit. So what I'm saying is I still spend the time that is dedicated towards increasing my success in the field, but a lot of it is in the off season and it's spread out over a year instead of maybe scouting 4 or 5 times during the off season and then hunting 60 days, you know, I'm scouting, you know, 100, yeah. 150 days, yeah. And then I'm hunting maybe 20 to 30, something sure. like that. So what I found is like the more I put into it, the more I prepare, the more I scout, the more I learn and dedicate in that off season, it's translated into more success in less time. So I think that's been, I mean, it's no secret. Everybody knows, like, you know, the really good hunters out there, the what I call the DIY guys, the yep. guys that earn it the hard way, that yep. don't have big leases, that don't hunt with outfitters and things like that, they prioritize scouting, yep. you know, and it really comes down to that. You know, I've never really pigeonholed myself into like one property or one state. I've made it a point. Well, I think it was just my sense of wanting more adventure and more experiences and more terrain, but I made it a point to try to hunt different areas of the country because I wanted to get better. Like that was always been a goal of mine is like, yeah. I want to get better. I don't want to be the best. I don't want to be a better hunter than you or you, but I just want to become a better hunter. I want to be the best hunter I can be. And I've always had that mindset. And I was like that with everything I did, but it was always about one thing. Like there was a time where I loved bass fishing and I was like, I want to be the best bass fisherman I could yep. be, you know? And it's like, I just ate it all up and consumed it. Well, then bow hunting came and it was like, there was no comparison. It's what I feel like I was born to do. And I just love it, you know? And now it's just, it's kind of turned into trying to fit as much as I can in, you know, in different states and different types of terrain, things that I'm, some things that I'm comfortable with, some things that are new that, you know that I don't know a lot about that I want to just the challenge. So my season typically ends up of a little bit of stuff that I've been to, yeah. you know, like a tried and true, you know, whatever it is, early season Kentucky. I've been doing that for years. I know I can go down there and have a good hunt. And then some other stuff that's like Western Plains whitetail that I have no experience doing or really steep mountain bucks or hill country. You know, I don't get a lot of that back home. So now I'm starting to insert myself into these new situations that I'm not as knowledgeable about or confident with because my goal is to get better. Yeah. You know, yeah. I don't want to be a hunter that kills a wall full of big bucks on his back 200 that I lease. Yep. You know, that's never really been my thing. I want to be able to go wherever and be dangerous. Yep. And and I don't know, that's just kind of what just drives me. Yep. And we talked a little bit earlier, like that, you know, now it's like even some of the Western stuff is gaining, yep, you know, my interest more and more. And it's because I don't know it. It's like I'm starting all over, learning a new thing, and I'm like a kid in a candy store, like taking in all this information. So,
yep, I love it.
I guess that's my story.
That's the perfect level set for what we're chatting about today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think 100% right. You're talking about, you know, being dangerous or just being like a good hunter. Like
efficient.
When I talk efficient, and you know, you talk about a guy like that guy's a hunter, and by when I think of that, that's a person that can plug themselves into a new environment, you know, through experience and learning and research, read that environment, make good decisions, you know, or go into it and find out what you see and then make decisions based off that and come out oftentimes successful.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with hunting the same place a lot.
Exactly.
And getting to know it. And there's definitely a whole set of knowledge and tools that go into that, I guess, type of hunting as well. There's nothing wrong or right. They're mm-hmm. they're just different. You know what I mean? Like, I think folks like maybe you or me or maybe you, Andy, as well, it sounds like I'm not going to know how to plant a food plot. You know, I know maybe some basics or something like that,
yeah,
or, you know, but I'm not going to be a soilologist, you know, but I might be like able to read a ridgeline or something,
right,
like that.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah, I want to preface this. I don't take anything away from
those
guys that prefer that
100%
style.
Yeah.
I mean, there's guys out there that put in a ton of work. I mean, you know that. And they've dedicated their life to mm-hmm. building a situation that
absolutely
produces big deer consistently. And I mean, that's awesome. I mean, and I see some of those guys and I pay attention and it's like, man, they work hard.
Absolutely.
It's just not my thing. I tend to get a little bored with that. And I have never been of the mindset like I want to kill the biggest bucks around. And if I did, I would alter my approach. I would apply for Iowa like I do. I would probably hunt Kansas and get a lease in Ohio. And I would hunt those three and I would try to get the best property that I could and put my time into like maybe those states. And if that was my goal, that's what I would do.
Sure.
But that's not my goal.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, originally Andy drew me to, you know, the stuff like that you're putting out there from a content standpoint, joining in on podcasts and whatnot, is it's relatable and it's something that the average guy can do. I mean, I was working at the Wisconsin DNR when I first came across stuff that, you know, you have going on, and it resonated with me because it's like, okay, I got 2 weeks of PTO that I can burn, and I can either choose to burn that all at once or getting into like what we're going to kind of chat about today. I can take like a one little 3-day weekend type deal, take a Friday off, buzz out to a state and try and be super efficient. And I know that's a lot of what we kind of have on the outline here is how can the average guy go from 0 to 60, not even 0 to 60, but just get into that and start learning from some of those experiences of, hey, I'm going to find the spot on a map, throw a dart at it, and this is, you know, how we get into it. So mm-hmm. I know, Mark, I know you've got a ton there.
I've got some notes here. And just to piggyback on, Eric, thank you for keep trying to bring this back to the topic at hand, and I'm going to immediately sidetrack us again. But I think, you know, you get into different types of hunting and what we're talking about here. I think a lot of times people are looking for adventure.
Absolutely, they
are. And we talk a lot here internally or just between us, you, me, Mucky, whatever, Cooper, about, you know, adventure. It can be in your own backyard. It doesn't have to be a sheep hunt, or it doesn't have to be, you know, a mountain goat hunt or some premier species or whatever. Adventure is seeing something new. Adventure is seeing some new country, or what's over that hill, or what does this region of the United States look like? So, and whitetails really offer a lot of diversity and a lot of adventure if a person is willing to go look for it. But when you get there, you want to
be efficient.
Be efficient.
Yep.
So there, I got a spot.
You did it.
Okay. I was sweating there for a minute. So you know, and I guess for the sake of this podcast, I think we'll talk about, you know, hunting, you know, maybe predominantly out of state, but also I think it applies to in-state stuff.
It does, no doubt.
There's a lot of spots that I hunt personally that sometimes the first time I'm seeing it, is during the hunting season.
And I think there's something to be said too, Andy, and I'm curious of your thoughts on this, but like I think people almost get in a rut where when they do go out of state, they become more efficient because they know that they're on the clock, they've got limited time. But then when they get back into their home state, they look at it through the lens of, man, I got September 15th through the end of January. I can do the slow play here. And then it almost ends up where their home state is where they struggle the most, and they are more efficient on the road.
Yeah.
So when it comes to, you know, Andy, from your perspective, when you are looking for, when you're heading out on a trip, like walk us through what that process looks like. You know, how much time are you taking, and how much time ahead of time have you spent scouting that area before you finally get out there?
Mm-hmm. That really depends on the hunt. So as far as the time that I usually spend on a whitetail hunt, like I mentioned earlier, I have two jobs, and I work at a school. I work at a school for children with special needs. I'm an occupational therapist. So it's a great job if you want to hunt around home. Yep. Because I get out about 3 o'clock. I could hunt the evenings in Michigan, which I did, you know, early on. I still do. But it's a bad job for a traveling hunter because our vacation time is set. You know, it's winter break, Christmas break. So it's tough. So what I usually do is, in the past, my out-of-state hunts started off at like 2 or 3 day hunts because that's all I could do. Now, that's not to say I wouldn't go back for 2 or more 3
right,
days, but
exactly.
I do like a weekend and maybe call in sick on a Monday or something like that. Well, now it's like I've been there. This is my 20th year. I have 186 days saved up. So
perfect.
I'm starting to be a little more okay with, okay, I take the weekend and I call in 2 days. We get 2 personal days a year. So I'm starting to use those more and more just because, you know, I feel like I've earned it a little bit. And I get the job done. I see my kids. I'm not missing anything. So that's usually what I devote. Now, some of these Western hunts obviously require a little longer. We can get into that later. It's a little tougher deal. But it's usually somewhere in that 2-5 would be a long one. Yeah. So like last year, for instance, I drew the Iowa archery tag, and I went down for 3 days late October, and then I went down planning to go down for another 4 days in the second week of November. And I ended up tagging out the first day on my second trip. But that's kind of how I devoted time to Iowa, because that's obviously a special tag that you wait a long time for. But yeah, to your point, or to answer your question as far as like scouting, if it's a rut hunt, which a lot of my out-of-state trips are, and especially in the beginning, they were rut hunts. Yeah. I feel more confident if I can get boots on the ground. I feel like I'm more prepared. I feel like I can really dissect a piece of ground and then pick out those few spots on that ground that I have the utmost confidence in. Whatever the reason be, I feel good about finding those spots that when I go back during the rut and I put my time in these spots, that they're going to be really good. Now, I don't need to do that. That's what I prefer to do because I really enjoy scouting and I like breaking a property down. But sometimes now, just because I wanted the challenge and I want to be able to just show up and go, I'll purposely not do that. Okay. So, and just show up during the rut and kind of go in and read the situation as I'm hitting boots on the ground for the first time. Yeah. So I really like that too. So for anyone listening, it's like you can do it either way. I feel like I'm at my best if I can get boots on the ground, but I still feel like I'm pretty effective doing it the other way too. So I've done both. And then I've also started to, in more recent years, started to travel more, like doing some early season trips or even some late season trips. Yeah. And with those, I don't really do as much like scouting in the off season. Like for those rut hunts, I would always go down and like as soon as snow melted, you know, where I could read the sign and really get a good lay of the land and find where the deer are bedding and where it looks like they were traveling and where everything kind of comes together. That's what I'd be looking for. But like these early season hunts, I'll go down and I'll use my scouting time the few days leading up to the hunt. So typically I would go to an area like Western Kentucky or, you know, Nebraska or something like that where I can use some glass. And that's where, you know, if I have 4 days to hunt, I'll scout too and then plan on hunting too. And my whole goal is to find a buck to go after, and it's like a one sit, one kill situation.
Wow.
And, you know, sometimes I find that, sometimes I don't, but I've had really good luck doing that. I feel like if I would went down in the spring and tried to scout for that hunt, you're missing too many pieces of the puzzle because you don't know what the food source is going to be. That's a huge part of the, you know, equation that time of year. Is there going to be, is that oak ridge that you're on even going to be dropping acorns? You don't know. Or are these bottom fields, are they going to be in beans like they were before, or are they going to be in standing corn and not as much of a draw in September? So on those hunts, I tend to be drawn towards areas that where glassing will benefit you, where if I can get high or get out of the way and glass from a distance and then move in, I really like that. So I'll plan those scouting days just before the hunt. So I'll go a little early. Like, for instance, well, this is a Western hunt, but I went to Nevada for an early season mule deer hunt.
Yeah.
And it was a 9-day backcountry trip, but I spent, it was 7 days of hunting and 2 days of scouting. You know what I mean? So it's, I do the same thing with the early season whitetail. I'll put those scouting days on the beginning.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. That makes sense.
But one thing you did mention too is like guys that when they sometimes they go out of state, they feel like you feel like maybe some guys are a little more efficient or better when they travel out of state. And I think there's a lot to be said for that too.
Yeah.
I see it even in my own hunting sometimes back home. It's like sometimes you play things a little more passively because you feel like you have that time, or I don't want to blow this deer out, you know, of this area, and I want to play it a little more carefully.
Yep.
And sometimes that can work for you, and sometimes you miss your opportunity.
Yeah.
Where it's like when you're out of state and you know you only have 5 days, it's like you're going for the home run every sit.
Yep,
you
exactly.
know, at least I am. Yeah. Like if it's a rut hunt, like I'm sitting dark to dark.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's not in one stand, I'm sitting till in this spot until midday, and then I'm going right to the next spot. I'm not taking a lunch. I'm not taking a break. You know, a nap or anything like that. It's like I'm maximizing my time, and because of that, you end up with more success.
Sure.
So, there's a lot to be said for that too. When you're on a time crunch, you tend to put, more into it,
absolutely.
And you know, you could be more successful just on that alone.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot there. I mean, like you said, you have that time crunch, you're more inclined to make those more aggressive moves, which I know, like, I struggle with that at times, you know, because you can be like, oh, man, I don't want to get in there and I don't want to blow a deer out.
Yeah.
But you're also not putting yourself in the game.
Yeah.
And so I think there's, you know, definitely probably a balance to be struck there. But, you know, and along with that, too, and I know even in-state or whatever, like, I'm generally hunting for, like a buck. Like, I got a picture of, like, you know, what a deer looks like that I, you know, would be super stoked to shoot.
Yep.
You know, where I think sometimes, you know, back home, if you do have a lot of places that you traditionally hunt, or maybe you have a piece of ground and you can, you know, manage it and run cams and kind of get that history with those deer, you might be, you know, stuck on a deer. You're trying to, you know, kill a deer where, man, the freedom of just going in and trying to kill a buck.
Yeah.
Is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that's, would you say that's part of like your success too, is like not your willingness to, like, it's not like you're selling, you're like, oh yeah, I'll shoot, you know, the first, you know, spike or 2 point that comes by, which I've been known to do, but but yeah, I mean, maybe talk a little bit about, like, you know, maybe setting, like, realistic, being realistic about, you know, maybe the deer that you want to chase around.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, usually at home there's a couple deer that I kind of, my attention draws to because they're, you know, bigger or older than the rest, and I put my time into those. Well, when you're going to an area you're not familiar with, you have no idea what's there.
Yep.
It's like, it's kind of like how we felt like when we were younger, before trail cameras, and we didn't know every single deer in the area or on the property or whatever. There was that sense of wonderment, and that's what I have when I go out of state. So yeah, I still like to target, you know, older age class deer. But it's all relative, you know. It might be a 3.5-year-old deer or something like that that I'm more than happy with. Especially if I'm hunting like say like an Illinois or a Kentucky or something, I have 3 days, you know, and a good 3-year-old buck comes by. Like, I'm more than happy with that.
Yep.
And then like in Iowa, you know, I was looking for something older, next level, and I was willing to put in that time. I was like, if this is a tag that deserves more time because of the money that I put into it, waiting. I mean, it took me 4 years. So my plan was to do, you know, three or four trips if necessary, and putting more time into that tag.
Yeah.
And then I was able to, you know, eventually take an animal that I was happy with.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, it just all depends. But yeah, a lot of times out of state, you know, it's not like I'm, you know, 180 or bust, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm looking for a solid representative. I adjust my goal or expectations depending on where I'm hunting, what the conditions are, what's the time of year, how much time I have to put into the hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still, you know, I've been on a lot of years. I've shot a lot of critters. I still enjoy shooting a good solid 3-year-old buck. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I do. And then there's other times where I let them walk right by. You know, I let some deer walk last year that were really nice that on any other year, I might be in a situation where I'd be super happy to take that deer. Yep. And sometimes it's too, for me, it's, what's the situation? Like I've had kind of a goal in mind, and then I find myself in a situation where it's like, you know, maybe you're glassing or you're scouting. It's like you see a buck bedded like in this in this prairie in this little thicket. You could just see his rack, and you're like, dude, this is gonna be awesome if I could sneak up and kill this deer. But it might not be exactly what your goal was as far as age or rack size or something. But it's like the hunt, the memory is what's gonna be amazing. So I found myself doing that sometimes too, you know. It's just, I think because I don't put that pressure on myself of like, oh, I got to shoot, you know, 160s to be like this guy or this guy. It's like, I have more fun with it, you know.
Absolutely.
I do. I go out there with no pressure and no expectation, and, you know, I shoot what I shoot. If I don't shoot one, it's okay, you know. So I don't know. That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah.
But I know some guys are different. They're a little more hardcore about the big, you know, big trophy deer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's super, super important to point out really how contextual deer hunting is or can be, and how that can shift. You know, you're like, oh yeah, you know, like I really want to, you know, shoot, you know, maybe this size of deer. But just like you said, you're like, oh my gosh, like if I could pull that off, like that'd be so amazing. I've never been in this situation before. Yeah. It gets back to more like that experience, that adventure component. You know, it's not all tied to what's, you know, on, you know, the bone growing on top of their head. I do that stuff all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, I've
absolutely.
People always say, or you often hear, like, don't pass on the first day what you'd shoot on the last day. And I'm like, I do that all the time. And but it's also because, like, I'm probably like, okay, maybe not getting one. Like, do I want to get one? Absolutely. But like, you know, sometimes you just don't want the hunt to be over either.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Andy, one thing you touched on too earlier was, you know, like learning experiences when you were starting out. Like you said a lot of like hunting came natural, but there were definitely things that like you did, you know, have like a learning curve getting into it and whatnot. What were some of those, like if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, okay, this is going to be the year that I do go on my little DIY whitetail trip, you know, a little 5-day or less hunt, what are some of the learning experiences that you've had that you would give to that person for advice?
Yeah. I'll answer this a couple different ways. Some of the early on mistakes that I made, you know, are ones that we all know. You know, I tended to overhunt stands. It's sit in that favorite stand, you know, 10, 20 times a season, and it's like your sightings go way down. I used to do that all the time, not understanding the wind. You know, I would always kind of pay attention to, like, what it was doing, like, right here.
Sure.
And try to keep the wind in my favor. But now it's like I have a much better understanding of, like, wind and thermals and how wind moves through different types of terrain and how older deer use wind, too.
Yeah.
You know, that took me a while to grasp that. And then once you get a better understanding of that, things tend to come together a little more because you can think, you can think more like a big buck and how he's going to maneuver through the terrain and how he's going to check his areas. And he doesn't do exactly what even the 2 and 3-year-old bucks do. So those are some of the big things that I think early on I struggled with, and I didn't even know I was struggling with it.
Speaking to wind and just diving into that a little bit, what things did you learn about the wind, you know, other than like, oh, it's in my face right here, I should be good right now, you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask that same question.
Yeah, so what I've learned is mature bucks, they always are using the wind in some way that benefits them. It depends on the time of the year. So let's say we're talking in the rut, right? So like I like to look for areas that, where big bucks or mature bucks tend to go to scent check their environment. So like, let's say they're looking for, it's the rut, they're looking for does, right? They're covering ground efficiently to try to find a hot doe.
Yeah.
So like those downwind sides of doe bedding are obviously really good. There may not be any sign there. In fact, the spot where I killed my Iowa buck, it's a really good story too. I'll tell you that in a minute, but there was no big buck sign. There was one scrape. But there was no buck beds anywhere. There was no rubs or anything. Yeah. But I knew it was a spot that is going to draw multiple bucks because of the substantial bedding cover that was there. Sure. So to a person that maybe doesn't have the confidence of recognizing that, or they need to see all this big buck sign, they might walk right by that and say, there's no bucks that live here. Yeah. You know, things like destinations, like food sources, they tend to, this can vary too, depending on if you're hunting a pressured area or unpressured area. So I don't want to make a blanket statement like this is what mature bucks do. Perfect. But they will tend to enter these spots in areas where they can scent check. So a lot of times in the fields, you'll see the, like these low spots. They'll come in there, not only because of maybe the wind is in their face, but like more the thermals. Yep. When they're entering or exiting their bedding area, they almost always enter in from downwind. They'll do kind of like a J-hook, the older deer. So, you know, I started to learn this kind of stuff on a primary scrape, same thing. Like there's this primary scrape in Iowa. I put a camera on it, and like October, it started about October 18th through about Halloween. I was consistently getting good bucks on this, like working the scrape, right? And then most of the time, right around that time, as soon as they start getting into the does, those scrapes tend to go a little cold. Yeah. You know, you'll start to see leaves in them. They're not freshened up. Well, they're actually still scent checking that scrape, but they're going to start doing it from more downwind. Yep. And a lot of people just think, okay, that scrape's inactive. It's not valuable anymore. Well, they still will, because does will still come through. They still work that. Does will come through the scrape too, and they sniff and leave their scent. And then these big bucks, well, instead of, because they're so focused on the does now and not as much on marking their territory, they'll scent these from downwind. Mm-hmm. So those scrapes can still be effective, but they're not actually hitting the scrape. Right. And these are things that I started to pick up on over time, that these bucks are scent checking these areas from downwind. Sure. I don't necessarily need the sign. I just need to know, like, this is a spot where a lot of things come together scent-wise, and the bucks will check it. Yep. Another good one is like in hill country, there's these spots where you'll find like in the bottoms where, let's say you got a couple ridge systems, and when you look on the topo, you'll see that all these fingers come down. Yep. Okay, and they kind of all come down in the same general direction. So it looks like, you know, you got a ridge over here, a ridge over here, and then they're all kind of pointing down. These points come down all into one area. Well, that creates a couple things. It creates a travel hub, because deer like to go up and down these ridges, down these points, right? They either go right to the side of the drainage, or they come right down the middle of the point. So you got this travel hub. Think of it as like a wheel hub with all these spokes, and all the spokes are the travel routes. Yep. So when they're going from this ridge, they're coming down here, crossing through that spot. Yep. So you got a travel hub, but you also have a thermal hub. So in the evenings, all the thermals drop, and they tend to pool in one area. So that's a great spot for a buck to cross through and scent check everything, not only because of the travel, but always also because of the scent pooling down there. Now, it could be very tricky to hunt because it's low.
That was my next question.
It could be very tricky to hunt, but the trick, what I found in those situations, I've had really good success in those. I avoid the ones that are real tight, the ravines and the drainages that are real tight, steep sides and tight. I haven't found a way to beat that. But if you can find the ones that are a little wider, and then you can get the wind blowing parallel with the ravine itself. So let's say everything's dumping down. Let's say you got, usually down there, there's some sort of like major crossing where you can see a lot of, you know, trails kind of crossing. A lot of times there's a scrape down there too. They'll put like a primary scrape down there. But if you can get down in that bottom with the wind blowing down the ravine in your face, and you get just downwind of that crossing, you need that wind to be blowing down the ravine so you're not getting crosswind like over a ridge top, you know, and then it's tumbling down in that ravine. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay.
So I found that situation, you don't even need big buck sign down there. You just got to be down there at the right time of year. Okay. And it's a I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing once you don't always need the big buck sign. I feel like outside of the rut, you do. You know, I really try to find that hot sign, even leading up to like late October, you know, right in there. I'm still more focused on sign. But once you get into that, like, you know, in the Midwest here, at least, you know, into that like November 3rd, 4th, 5th and on, a lot of that big buck sign tends to kind of dry up. Sure. And the focus, their focus is different.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. They're doing different things. They're gone to maybe, you know, staying pretty tight to their bedding, going to food, maybe hitting a primary food source later in the evening, to where like they're just traveling a lot more during during that rut time, or at least that seeking phase, I guess, right?
Yeah. And you mentioned that your Iowa story was a good one that kind of supported some of this too.
So I've got one more question actually. So when you're
got a hand raising policy on this podcast.
When you're hunting those bottoms, is that, you know, you're talking about, you know, the thermals sucking down. Yeah. So is that an evening only hunt for you, or would you hunt something like that in the morning possibly?
And is it weather dependent? Does like rain or moisture weigh into your decision there at all?
So I've hunted those spots all day. Mm-hmm. Because you have it's not only a thermal hub, it's a travel hub too. So
okay.
the travel hub it says, say it was just on flat ground, you know, then similar situation where you got a lot of things coming together. Like the Iowa story that I'll tell you is similar. The travel hub itself is going to be a major draw when the bucks are on the move and they're trying to be efficient and they're trying to smell as much of their environment as they can with as little travel as possible. Okay. You know, so these are those high percentage spots where it's like you're just going to get more cross movement from bucks in the area. Like I can go to this spot and scent check a lot of different things. You know, so it doesn't necessarily need to be an evening thing. Now, yes, if you're in, you know, if you're more in hill country and you got a rising thermal, you know, in the morning, things can be a little tricky. But again, like when I'm looking at a situation like that, I'm like, okay, is it dead calm? And the thermals are, we got a really strong thermal kick. You know, it's like, it's a high pressure day and the sun is bright and it's supposed to warm up from 35 to 65. You're going to get a strong upward draft of thermals for a good portion of that day. So that might be a situation where I maybe not sit there because it's a calm wind. But if I got a 10 to 15 mile an hour wind and it's blowing down that ravine like I described, and it's in my face and I can get just downwind of where all that stuff comes together, I'm hunting it.
Yeah. Gotcha.
You know, because now that wind is going to override those thermals, and I can still play it safely. And I'm not necessarily down there for just the thermal hub, but for the travel hub itself.
Got it.
You know, so during the rut, I look for those high percentage spots. You know, I really look for those high percentage spots. And that Iowa buck, that was a high percentage spot. So I'll try to paint this picture. This was on a piece of like walk-in ground. They have like it's private land with public access. But anyway, there's the property next to, when you zoom out on the aerial photo, you see this substantial giant block of like dark timber, like cedars. I mean, you're like, wow, that's going to hold a lot of deer. And the guy, you know, whoever owned it, you could see, you know, he had some food plots and stuff up there. So I knew that was going to hold a ton of deer and more, you know, more interested in it. I knew it was going to hold a lot of does. So when I was out there in the spring, I was looking for this, I was scouting this because that area drew my attention. And so just outside of that, on the property that I could hunt, there was these ravines coming out there. So the property itself was pretty wide open, but then there were these wooded like drainage ditches that came out of his property and they ran north and south. Okay. So there was three of them that came out of there. So it's like, there were open fields and then they dropped down into these kind of not real steep, but like these shallow drainage ditches. And they were leading out of that bedding area, and they were leading north. And then on the other side of the road to the north was tons of ag field, more food than, you know, the best food available in that area. So now I had primo bedding. I had three distinct travel routes coming from bed to feed. And in the middle of that third ravine, actually right on the edge of that bedding area, just onto where I could hunt, there was a really good primary scrape. That was the only buck sign that I saw on that whole piece. But what I gave me the confidence to sit there was like, okay, if I sit here with a south wind, yep. I'm going to be on the downwind side of this doe bedding, which is already something I like. Yep. Okay. But I'm also, there's three drainages that go from bed to feed. Okay. Those are great little pinch points during the rut or any time of year, really. And now I have this primary scrape here too. So that's three things that I felt like I had that were in my favor for that time of year.
And what time of year was that? That was
yeah. So I went there late October was my first trip. Okay. And then my second trip was the second week of November.
Okay.
And so I felt real confident in that. And then one thing I know too is like, you know, these bucks will, they like to check that downwind side of bedding. And there may or may not be a trail there. Sometimes there's not even a trail there, or maybe it's real faint.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But it's not something that's like they take the same route every time. It's like they go there and they scent check. But what they'll often do too is like when you get a bedding area and a feeding area, and then you got these trails or these travel routes, they like to cut those perpendicular too, because now they can scent check every single deer that traveled down that. So I got downwind of bedding, I got travel from bed to feed in three different areas coming out of that bedding. So I already know it's like I got one reason for a buck to be here because it's downwind side of bedding. I got another reason because it's a travel hub coming out of there. There's three major travel routes, and a buck can just cross section that and know every deer that came by. And I got this awesome primary scrape. Like, it was one of those ones where it's like really big. You could tell it's been there for probably a decade or more, and it had good perimeter cover. You know, it's like, it's the scrape that you want, not like your typical field edge scrape.
Uh-huh. Right. I'm glad you touched on that, because I was going to ask, like, what makes a primary scrape?
Yeah, we can get into that too. And then, so it was just one of those things where it's like, there's a lot coming together here, even though the buck sign isn't here. And I sat there late October. I sat there twice. I sat in one of the little travel routes that came out, and I saw a couple of bucks. I passed on, I don't know, like a nice 2-year-old deer. Well, then I ended up hunting a different area. I got eyes on a really big buck on a different piece of public, and he was like mid 160s, like a big giant, just clean eight. And I really wanted to get him. So he kind of got my attention for the next few days.
Yeah.
Well, then I had to go home, and I ended up shooting my target buck in Ohio, a really cool old deer that I had been chasing for a couple of years, on November 4th. So I took care of him the next day, and then it was November 5th, which is my birthday. I drove back down to Iowa, slept, woke up, and then hunted the November 6th, and I went back to that spot I was describing to you guys. Anyway, I adjusted from the one little drainage to the middle drainage, and I was sitting there, I was set up with that south wind, so I had a lot of things working for me, and I had this really big mature 10 point come out of the drainage that I had set in private prior, and he comes and he's scent checking those. He's basically running perpendicular to those travel routes so he can scent check those areas, and he's downwind of bedding, so he's doing exactly what I expected bucks to do. I think he was the second buck I saw, but this one was a big shooter. But he was just out of range, too far downwind. Yeah. He ended up getting my wind, and I was like, oh, man, you know, like, darn it. Am I off here? Do I need to move a little bit more? Are other bucks going to do that? So as I'm playing this out in my head, do I need to move? I start to hear footsteps, and I look, and I see another buck coming on that same exact trail that this one was, but he's coming from the opposite way. So they're doing the same thing, scent checking. And I look, I put my binoculars up, and I just see, like, this big wall of tines.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
generally a good sign.
Yeah, I'm like, holy crap. Like, you know, like a really unique deer. It was one of those ones where, like, at that moment, like we talked about earlier, I didn't care how old he was. Yeah. Like, I'm on a DIY hunt. Like, I'm not managing deer here. Like, I've never seen a deer like that. Yeah. So, again, he's about to pass just out of range. And for whatever reason, he stops. And I think, just judging by I've played this out in my head, because I couldn't make sense of why. Like, he's just about to get downwind of me, and he stops, and then he just starts coming my direction. I'm like, that never happens. Like, there's no reason for him to do that. The only thing I can think of is that I was within shooting distance of that primary scrape, and he got right downwind of that scrape, and he stopped. Like, right when he got in that scent stream, he stopped and took a right angle and started coming into that scrape. So I think he was going to come into that. That's the only thing I can think of. Like, maybe there was some scent laid down there. Maybe he was going to come in and work it. I don't know.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, he starts coming, and it's like my wind's blowing here, and he's coming here. It's just cutting. And he ends up coming, I mean, really close, like 7 yards, and I drew back, and I ended up getting him. But he was just an awesome deer. He ended up with 19, he had 19 points. And he was just like, it's just like a wall of tines, like this non-typical. And I don't think he was a particularly really old deer. I've told my friends this. I was like, I bet you this deer's 3 years old. Yeah. You know, I really think he was. That other buck I saw earlier was a much older deer. But this deer just had everything you want in a whitetail. You know, he's super unique, super cool. But that's an example, I mean, one of many, but of an example of a spot that I look for during the rut that doesn't necessarily need sign. I look for travel hubs where a lot of things come together, thermal hubs. I look for those areas that are going to draw a lot of bucks in so that they can scent check. So that's one thing, like over time, that I've noticed how these older deer, you know, so let's say a 3.5-year-old up, you know, that are in moderately to high pressured areas, like this is how they use the area. Right. You know, this is how they work their area so that they stay safe when it's outside of the rut, or how they find does efficiently with as minimal travel as possible. And you might see completely different behavior if you're hunting a big lease where you and your buddy are hunting and you're managing deer, and you got deer coming out into the food plot. And, you know, a lot of times when you get like in a situation like that and you got high deer density, and like they feel comfortable because they've been out in that plot dozens and dozens of times with no repercussions or no encounters. Yep. Or they see, you know, the 20 or 30 deer get up and go out there, and they're out there feeding, and it's like, okay, you know, it's safe.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not what a lot of us get to experience.
Right. And the other thing that I picked up on that too is it sounds like you had, obviously you had that spot that you had a really good grasp on. You glassed up another buck in a spot that you threw a couple sits at. And I'm assuming that you probably had several other really high odd spots, and getting to the, you know, killing more bucks on less time. And this is, you know, definitely filling the gaps here, Andy. But I'd imagine that your approach is throw more sits at very high odd spots, very strategically. Throw less sits at several high odd spots than more sits at just being in the woods.
That's exactly right. That's I mean, that eventually I knew it would kind of come around full circle to that, but that's what it is. It's putting your time into those very high percentage spots. And during the rut, it's spots like that.
Yeah.
Outside of the rut, it might be where I'm sitting back and I might be scouting several times a week. You know, I might get out of work and I might go scout and check a camera. I might walk a field edge to see if there's any big tracks.
And is this during season, though?
During season.
Yeah.
So what I'm looking for is, like, I want to know that the buck that I'm after or a buck that I'm interested in is there. I don't hardly ever just go sit and hope anymore. I used to do that a lot, you know, and you just put in time and, oh, I see one over there. Okay, now you're in the game. Yeah. Well, now I when I said earlier, it's like I may not spend as much time hunting, but I do spend the time towards my success, you know, and that's in the form of scouting. So now it might be, you know, that Ohio buck I was glassing every day before work and after work, you know, almost every day that I could before work and after work. And I was, but finally when I started getting on to him, that was the time to go in. So now it's more, I look for that high percentage, like, okay, he's in there. Now I'm going to go in. It's a high percentage spot, or the sign is telling me he's in there. A trail cam picture tells me he's in the area, and now it's time to go. Instead of like, oh, I found this cool buck bed back then, I'm going to go hunt it. I don't even know what's there. I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. How much is trail cameras factoring into your strategy right now?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, quite a bit, but I've seen a lot of hunters start to come, you know, kind of all the way to the point where it's like that's all they rely on.
Right, exactly.
And I've even started to feel like there's times where it's like, man, I'm relying too much on trail cameras, and I don't like that. I don't like that feeling for me personally. So it is definitely a part. It's definitely a part of my strategy. Glassing is a huge part of my strategy. You know, on the ground, boots on the ground, scouting is a big part of my strategy. And I think because all kind of my blend of all three of those is what really helps me personally be successful. If I relied just on the trail cameras, I feel like I'd be missing so much because of what I find. So, you know, this time of year, it's like all your buddies, you know, you start texting all these big bucks. Like, I'm getting pictures from my friends, like trail cameras, yeah. big bucks. Yep. Every picture that I have sent out to my closest friends have all been glassing pictures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, you know, I'm finding more and bigger bucks in a wide variety of areas, and they're, you know, pulling a couple bucks from a specific spot or a specific property. You know what I mean? Not to put anyone down. It's
right.
Just,
exactly.
Yeah. It's a blend of those things that I think are very important. And I don't want to fall into that trap of just relying on trail cameras and hunting off your cameras. And even worse yet, like the cell camera thing, you know, it's like, you know, they're very cool. You know, I go back and forth with them if I'm okay with them or not, but it's like, I see a lot of guys now, there's guys I know that are running 40, 50 cell cameras, and they just sit back and wait. And, you know, when one shows up, they go in and hunt, and they all of a sudden they're starting to be really successful and effective at shooting these bigger bucks, which is cool. You know, it's cool, and I'm happy for them, but I personally don't want that. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be out there mixing it up and trying to figure things out of myself, not letting technology tell me when and where to hunt.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Makes total sense.
Well, I mean, you're like broadening the scope of the tools in your toolbox, right? Like, they're all great tools.
Yes.
But it'd be like if you're like, oh, I only use trail cameras, which, you know, and a person, maybe that's all the time they have. So that's what you have to do. I mean, you know, time is a tool as well. Some people have more, some people have less of it. But, you know, it's like, oh, if you had, you know, your toolbox and you're like, well, I've got a wrench.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Well, cool, man. Like, that's going to work sometimes.
Right,
but,
right.
Yeah, blending all those things together, I think, is what, and having that diversity of scouting tools. And you look at trail cameras, super handy, right? I mean, amazing, amazing tool. But they are like a snapshot, literally. Like, they're a literal snapshot of a specific spot in time where, like you said, you're running around using your glass, checking multiple places. Yep. I mean, you're seeing a lot of country for sure.
Yeah. And there's so much you could learn too from a trail cam picture. Like, I think probably your average hunter gets a trail cam picture and he's like, okay, there's a big buck that's back here somewhere, you know, on this date, and now I'm going to go back and sit. Yep. Well, what you can do, like, especially if you get, you know, multiple pictures of that deer, maybe multiple spots or even over a span of a year or two, it's like, you could really dive down deep. It's like, okay, so I map all this stuff out. Like, when there's a certain deer that I start to learn about and I start to get pictures and sightings, I write everything out, and I keep track of everything. So now, like, patterns start to emerge, right? So it's like okay, for instance, I'm thinking back of this big 9-point that I shot in Michigan a few years ago. I got pictures of him or sightings 3 years in a row in the span of like October 24th through like the 27th. Okay. So it wasn't just, I got a picture. Oh, okay. I'm going to go sit back here now. It was like, okay, I started to develop this pattern of like, okay, this buck is in this area during this short time frame of the pre-rut for whatever reason. You know, it's a part of Michigan that's a lot of broken up, small private pieces and stuff, but it's like, I don't know where he is bedding. I don't have access to where he is bedding, but I do know that he uses this area during this short time frame. And that first year I got him, I was just like, oh, wow, this is an awesome deer. You know, I want to try to hunt him. Let's try to track him down. Well, I didn't get him. And then the next year, after a few sightings and a few more pictures, it's like, okay, he's back at the same exact time, doing the same exact stuff, hitting these scrapes. Okay, how can I capitalize on this? Like, you know, maybe I can get him here. I found a spot that had all his sign. And it, you know, it would open up and it'd be fresh. And it's like, okay, he's here now. Now I got to hunt him. Well, I didn't get him that year either. Well, then all the next year, it's like, now I'm starting to go through all these pictures. Like, I got all this data, right? You know, I got these sightings. I got these pictures. I got his sign popping up here. I got his tracks over here. And now it's like, okay, where's this deer coming from most of the time? Okay, he's coming from over here on this point, way over on this piece of private. How's he getting here? Well, he's probably taking this inside corner of this. There's like a lowland swamp there, and there's this little piece of high ground that kind of wrapped around all the ag fields. I was like, I bet you he's coming right through there, because down there was like waist deep water.
Right.
I was like, I bet you he's taking that inside corner and coming around, and he's got all this sign over here, this cool primary scrape area, and there's rubs, and I found his tracks over there. And then I'm starting to figure all this out, and it's like, okay, where do I need to be to kill this deer? Like, the year prior, I sat in that spot where all that sign was. And if you were I think any hunter, I mean, I certainly did. I went in there. I was like, this is the spot. This is where all his sign is. It's a, you know, he's coming in here late October. He's like, these scrapes, this spot is hot. Like, this is where I'm going to kill him. Well, what I didn't really take into account was like, it was a really large kind of woods, like swampy woods. But in that spot was like an opening kind of in the middle. And there were some oaks there that were dropping acorns and stuff. So it had a couple things going for it. But because it was an opening, I was hunting it with a north wind, which I thought I needed. Well, what the wind would do, it would come over the top, it'd hit that opening and then circle back and blow back to the north. So it took me a few times of hunting that before I realized, like, oh man, I cannot hunt this spot. I literally can't hunt this spot, even though the sign is telling me to hunt it. And that second year I hunted him, he got me in there. He was actually coming into that spot, and he winded me, even though the forecast and the way the wind was coming over the trees, it should have been in my face. Well, it wasn't. It blew it right back to him. Yep. So the third year, I figured out, it's like, okay, I can't hunt where the sign is. I got to hunt somewhere between where he's bedding and that spot, because he clearly wants to go into that area and mark his territory up. So I ended up hunting that spot I was telling you about earlier, that inside corner. Yeah. No sign there. It's just a little bit tighter to it where I thought he was bedding, at least some of the time. Yep. And I ended up sitting there, and on my first sit, so the trail cam pictures and sightings indicated that he was using this area in that short window. As for whatever reason, it was very distinct, like 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th, somewhere in there. And then it would taper off. Like, I'd get a picture here, like November 2nd, maybe a sighting November 7th. Like, he was around, but like, that late October time frame, it's like, boom, he's right in this little small area.
What time of day, Andy, were you getting those pictures? Was it all kind of at a similar time or random? Or
they were kind of, well, it seemed like they started off more like in the evening, like after dark.
Mm-hmm.
And not long after dark. But so I knew he was close. But then as it kind of got towards like that 25th, 26th time frame, it's like, okay, I'd get a picture of him at like 9 a.m. at the scrape.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? So all of a sudden, it's like he's starting to hit in daylight a little more. And then I got a visual of him. I was sitting back more in an observation stand, and I got a visual of him, and he was kind of back in that woods a little bit and kind of working an edge over there. So it was kind of random. But what I did notice was like when he first started in that area, like all my pictures seemed to be at night, and then it was like, okay, then he was getting closer to daylight, then here's a couple at daylight, here's one at last light. So he seemed to be moving more and less depending on the day, but it seemed to be more in daylight as the time went on. But he also seemed to be coming from different areas as far as I could tell. But this one point where I thought he was bedding, it would have been a north wind, because a lot of times they'll bet on these points where the wind blows down the point. And I had enough intel, pictures, and sightings where I knew he was coming from that direction. That was the only spot I could make sense of where he was. And so that inside corner was perfect. So I ended up, that time frame came. I didn't hunt it at all October. And I was waiting for his sign or a picture to pop up. And we got a really nice cold front on October 25th. Mm. And I went in there, and I was going to check the camera, but I was like, you know what, I'm just going to hunt because I don't want to go in there in case he's somewhere close. I don't want to booger it up. But as I'm walking down this, it's a field edge of like standing corn and woods, like all these scrapes are opened up, like real fresh and big, yeah, big tracks. And this is a spot where it's like, you're not getting multiple big bucks in here. There's a big buck. Yep. So I was like, he's here. Like, he is here. And I climbed up in that stand that night, and it was interesting because I was sitting up there, and you know, Michigan has tons of hunting pressure, and I'm up in the stand, and it's like, I see a truck coming here, this guy pulling in. Like, there were hunters surrounding this whole area. And at last light, I see, all of a sudden I look down at that point, which is off a property I couldn't hunt, and I see legs, like just like a deer stand up, and I just see legs, and I'm like, what is that? You know, I was like, is that him? And I got the binoculars up, and all of a sudden he steps out, and it's him. And he's like, he's a 24 inch wide nine. He was like 160.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, like Bullwinkle, right? That's what he looks like. So he steps out into the edge of the standing corn, and then he goes right back into the woods. And I was like, he's going to come right down. He's going to come right down around this inside corner where I was set up. So I couldn't see him coming, but like it's starting to get a little darker. I was like, he's got to hurry, you know? And all of a sudden it's like, there he is. I see his rack coming, and he comes right around that inside corner leading right to where all that sign was. Where it told me to hunt the one time, but then I quickly learned I couldn't, and I ended up getting a shot at him right there. So it's one of the deer that I'm most proud of because he was in such a high pressure area. A lot of people were after that deer, and it took me 3 years to figure him out. So yeah, that's a pretty cool story.
That is cool.
That's a great story. I mean, that's a great example of, you know, honestly, like in my opinion, like the power of podcasts like this. Like, you have 3 years invested in that deer. Yeah. But all that information is so good. Now somebody can see maybe a similar situation to that and put their puzzle pieces together a lot faster. So thank you, Andy, for your 3 years of dedication to that deer.
Yep.
Man, so many good I mean, you can go in a million different directions.
Yes, you can. One question I had, Andy, too, is like when it comes to, you know, like a lot of these DIY trips that you're doing, I'm assuming you're super mobile. What does your camp setup look like?
Yeah, so it's a couple different things. So if I can find a lot of these times these whitetail hunts, it's like it's not like a backcountry hunt or anything. So if I find like if I'm going, sometimes I'll go with a buddy. A lot of times I'm by myself. But if we can find just like a cheap motel that's close by, and we can share that and get that cost down, we'll do that. I do not like to spend a lot of money, like staying somewhere. I'm trying to do this as cheap as possible. I have a tent set up that I use, the same one I use like when I go, you know, out west.
Yeah.
I'll use that a lot of times, and I'll bring my little camp stove and everything. I like that. I've slept in my car or truck like more times than I want to talk about. But as I get older, like I got a bad back and stuff, I start to notice like a good night's sleep is really,
for sure,
really important for me. Like when I was younger doing this, I would just sleep in the truck and it was like not a big deal, but it's starting to become more of a big deal. But yeah, I like to stay light and mobile. You know, just I use all my backcountry stuff, and I really like that. But a lot of times too, like a lot of these areas I go, like I'll go out east and I'll hunt Maryland, I'll go to Nebraska. Well, I've made friends in these places. So now a lot of times it's like I have a friend there and they'll just let me stay with them. You know, and it's like kind of that's my home base. And then there's other areas where I don't know anybody, and that's when I'll do the camp or find a cheap motel and stuff. I've stayed in some dirty motels, man.
I assumed it would be a lot of your backcountry stuff, too. I figured that's where you take that. And I think that's one thing a lot of folks, like, especially in the whitetail world, you know, like, there's definitely that group of people that is thinking about it that way. But I also think there's a bigger portion of that, you know, might look at some of these backcountry camping, you know, pieces of equipment, might kind of thumb their nose up at it. But man, if you do want to bounce around, that's so critical to have stuff like that, because you can just, you know, you can be here tomorrow, and if you're burning this spot out, or if you're not seeing what you want to see, you're just on to the next spot.
Yeah,
and it's very easy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really, it's like we talk about, like, you, like, it sounds like you have a pretty mobile hunt strategy, like, you know, or, you know, you bounce and you're kind of going light and fast. But I think that's a good point, Eric, because that can apply to your camp, too. It's not like you've, like, oh, I've set up this elaborate tent and this camp setup that literally, like, the last thing I want to do is tear it down. Yeah. Like, if you've got maybe more of that backcountry kit and, you know, gives it a little bit more dual purpose, it's not like for my once a year mule deer hunt. You
right,
know, I can use it on my, you know, whatever, my Montana hunt or my North, you know, like Montana whitetail hunt or North Dakota, South Dakota, wherever you end up, wherever whitetails live. But and all that gear is designed to keep you comfortable in uncomfortable situations. Yep. And getting back to what you were saying, you know, good night's sleep, you know, being able to stretch your back out, things like that. I mean, that's super important.
Yeah.
And gear is fun.
Yeah, it is.
It's cool.
So one, I know we're getting close on time, but what are, if you had to leave somebody with one piece of advice, like one big takeaway that, you know, they want to do this for, they want to start getting into the DIY whitetail world, what would that be?
One thing I always try to tell guys that I think has helped me is when I started out, you know, for the first, you know, 10, 15 years, I always advise people to be aggressive. And there's a reason for that. Not because I think being aggressive is the best way to kill that deer every time.
Yep.
But what happens was when you're aggressive, you are constantly putting yourself in the game with things. Okay. So when you're passive, let's say you got 30 days to hunt and you're more of a passive hunter and you sit back and you see that deer kind of walk over the hill and you're like, oh, all right, well, I'll sit here tomorrow. Maybe he'll come this way. Okay, well, you didn't really learn much, and you're not in the game with that deer, really, you know, unless he does that, which is probably unlikely. But if you have that approach, you're sitting back, and you're not really thrusting yourself into the mix of the action where you can actually learn.
Sure.
So by being aggressive, it's like, okay, he's going over the hill. It's like, okay, I'm going over there. I'm going to try to set up by where that deer walked by, or I'm going to find out where he's going. I'm going to try to learn more. I'm going to get in there and try to figure it out. But by doing that, okay, now you're in the game. Now you're actually in class instead of sitting outside of class looking in the window. Mm-hmm. You get what I mean?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, I think for me, what I started to do is, like, I was so aggressive with things and making all these mistakes, I started to figure out what my limits were, what I could get away with, what I couldn't, what worked, what didn't, what I needed to improve on, what I'm good at. And then you start to develop, like, your instincts become better. Yeah. Okay. So now it's like, okay, I've been in this situation. I've been in this game before. Like, this didn't work last time. Like, I feel like this should work. So those are your instincts starting to play in, or like, I've seen this situation before. Like, I've been in this spot, like in Iowa, where all this stuff came together and all the bucks were down, you know, they came through here. Like, this is similar. I know how to do this, or I didn't do it right before. Like, this is what I need to do this time, I think. So now your instincts are starting to develop because you've been aggressive, because you've been in the game so many times. So now it's over, now this point, like, I trust my instincts a lot. I get these, like, intuitions and these feelings. I've learned to trust them because it's like they're all pulling from all these old experiences that I had. Had I sat back and been passive and kind of, like I said, and you're looking in the window of the classroom instead of in the classroom, I wouldn't have all that information to pull from, all those mistakes that helped me build to whatever type of hunter I am now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I always tell guys, be aggressive, you know, because when you're aggressive, you're learning. You're making those mistakes. Okay, now you learned. You got better, you know? So when I think of, like, people I know that, you know, have been hunting longer than me and they still struggle and they're maybe not happy with the success, when I really think about it and look at it, they're more of passive hunters.
Yeah.
They tend to hunt the same areas, the same times, the same way. And it's like, if your goal is to become a better hunter, you really need to get in there and learn. And by being aggressive, it just helps you. You learn from all those mistakes that you make, because you're going to make a ton of them. Yeah. I mean, I have made a ton of mistakes early on. It's like, you guys are probably like, look, like, what's that guy doing? Like, why is he doing that? Like, dumb stuff. But like, that's how you learn. And then you never really know what your limits are, you know, unless you push them.
Sure.
Like, okay, can that deer went in that thicket. Can I still hunt through there with my bow? Can I get in close enough to get a shot at him? Like, I don't know. I think I can. And then you do it, and you don't, and you're like, well, I came close. Like, if I would have done this, if I would have got within 60 yards and then just sat and waited for him to get up and move, I probably could have killed him.
Yeah.
So, like, you would never know that you can get away with that if you find yourself in that situation had you not tried it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice is to get out there and be aggressive and have that mindset of, like, learning and trust your instincts. And your instincts will be wrong. But then they're constantly recalculating because you're messing up here. Okay, this worked. This didn't work. Okay, this is what I need to do next time. They're constantly recalculating, and they get better over time. So now it feels like a lot of times I get these feelings or these intuitions, or it's my instincts kicking in. It's like, a lot of times they're right. More times than not, they're right.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big one.
I agree, and
again, something I can get better at is, like, don't be afraid to screw up.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And get in there and, you know, mix it up. And, hey, you know, you might screw it up, but you're going to learn something from either what you saw, what that deer did, or you might go into. I know I've gone into some spots where you never would have found out something about that deer unless you charged into where they were. Not charged in, you know, but you're like, oh, his bed looks like that. Or, yeah, there are four rubs right here. Like, he's using this a lot, you know, or something like that.
Exactly.
So the more I think about deer hunting, this is just like an observation. It might be wrong, or people might think it's weird. So even though I love to fish, but I always choose hunting over fishing. But I've been thinking of deer hunting like fishing lately, as far as, like, the terrain does this, or it's doing that, or the wind, you know, wind works like water. And, you know, you think of, like, oh, where a trout might hold in the stream. Well, bucks or deer are kind of doing similar things based on, they're going to hold here, they're going to lay here, they got easy travel there. And then from an aggressive standpoint, I think of deer hunting, like, you could be a bobber fisherman. And a bobber's pretty effective, you know. But, you know, if you're just going to go out, cast out the old red and white, and sit in your lawn chair and hope something swims by, which it works every now and again. Or you're going to pitch one right at that stump and go for it, you know, because that's where it's at.
Yeah.
That's a really good example.
That is a great analogy. I like it.
I'm going to start pitching more, Eric.
Yeah.
Just get right in there. You know, and I guess you bring that even a little bit further. Sometimes you're going to pitch in there and you're going to break it off.
Right, exactly.
That's right.
Yep. 100%.
Be aggressive.
I love it.
They used to cheer that at the old high school football games, Eric.
I know. I do remember.
Why didn't I take that advice sooner?
It's been crammed down your throat the whole time, and now we just got to. It's been right there. Now we just got to do it
right in front of my face, Andy. We were talking earlier. You've hunted 21 states.
Yeah.
Never Wisconsin. Thank goodness. Stay out of here.
Yeah.
leave some for the rest of us. But it sounds like you've been hunting a little bit more out west and diversifying. Now we're broadening the scope of our topic, but you've been diversifying your hunting portfolio as far as critters that you're chasing after. What have you been up to in regards to that? And how does, like, a lot of your whitetail experience, you know, translate over to that?
Yeah. So, a few years back I started, going out west. It started with antelope, which was awesome. You know, it's still one of my favorite hunts. Shot a few antelope with my bow, and then I got into the mule deer and now even the elk. So this year I actually have two mule deer hunts planned and an elk hunt. So, I mean, this year specifically is heavily weighted towards western hunting, and the whitetail is going to take a little bit more of a backseat, even though I will get, you know, some whitetail hunting in too. But it's like we talked about earlier, for me, it's a whole new world. I feel like I did when I started whitetail hunting, where I don't necessarily have the confidence that I have in whitetail hunting. And I'm like that new kid that's learning everything. And I'm just like, you know, bright eyed, and it's like where you hunt them. And you don't know all the habits of these critters. And so it's just really exciting to be kind of thrusted back into like that, almost like that beginner. Yeah. But I will say, like, you know, I think the things I've learned whitetail hunting is specifically hunting whitetails in Michigan, which I think is, you know, we didn't really touch on. I do think is a really substantial reason why I'm able to go to some of these other states and have such consistent success, is because I do believe that the bucks that we hunt in Michigan are some of the cagiest bucks. It's been my experience in every other, you know, more so in every other state I've hunted. So I do think it was kind of like some good proving grounds to learn, you know, because you really got to do everything perfect. There's so few of them around, and there's usually many people after that one particular deer on that block or in that area. Yep. So it is a little more challenging, but it has definitely seemed to help even with the western hunts too. You know, you develop that instinct of a hunter, you know, when to move, when not to move. And because I've never pigeonholed myself into like one tactic for whitetail hunting. Like, I don't always just climb up in a tree stand or a tree saddle and sit over a scrape or a food plot. Like, a lot of times I'm ground hunting, or I'm still hunting with my bow and sneaking around and glassing. So when I went out west, it was just like more of the stuff that I've already done, but it's even more important out there, you know, to use those skills. So I don't know. I just feel like I'm developing a whole new set of skills by hunting out there, and the animals are different, and the where you get to hunt them is just, you know, I've always been drawn towards the west. You know, if it weren't for family, I'd be out there. Yeah. I'm just in love with it right now, and you know, just trying to get better.
Yep, that's awesome.
Do you? I mean, it sounds like like you're kind of starting that. So, I mean, you're a good hunter, so I mean, I think a lot of that just translates over, and you can, you know, jump into something new and definitely have a head start. But do you see that western stuff kind of being like that new horizon of, like, you know, you're going to do more and more and more and more of it and less whitetail hunting, or just try and keep it an even mix, or whitetails are just your kind of your core passion and always will be?
Yeah, I think it's going to be – I don't think it's going to be more and more and more, because – my job, I'm very, very limited, on that. What I have looked more into is, like, you know, we usually start, I work year round, but the summer schedule is shorter, and I do get a couple weeks off usually in August. So I started to look at some of those August seasons, which a lot of times is antelope or, you know, the Nevada archery mule deer, like it was August. So I am starting to look more into those because those are hunts I can go on and it's like, I don't need to be back.
Yeah.
You know, in 4 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, this year I this is the most, you know, I've never done like two Western hunts in a year and I'm doing them this year. So it is more than usual. This isn't going to be the regular. Yeah. Whitetails are always going to be there. I love them. I love them, and I don't. They're never gonna. I don't think they're ever gonna take a back seat. But I definitely want to. I definitely want to experience more of the Western stuff.
I'm for sure.
I'm mad at myself for waiting so long. Like, if I started hunting out west when I started traveling for whitetails, I could have drawn some primo tags by now.
Oh yeah.
But I got in the game late, and it is what it is. But I've enjoyed it and had some success out there, and just. Looking forward to more.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Absolutely. Man.
Got a couple rapid fire questions
this off. I like it.
All right. Well, this one might be less of a rapid fire, but you're talking about your family, and you have a daughter. She's here with us today, actually. She left. She got bored. we may need to find her. Somebody. But is she into hunting, or how are you? Like, and I guess if so, like, what are some things that you're doing to make that like something that you think she'll want to do or enjoy doing?
Yeah, she shot a real big turkey last year, bigger than mine actually.
So you're not taking her again?
Yeah, she's done.
Yeah.
But no, she shot her fourth deer this year. Yep, and she shot her first buck. So cool. Very cool. She does seem to enjoy it. She's not as hardcore about it as me. I might ask her five times, and she might say she wants to go one of those five. Okay. You know, so I'm not trying to push it, but I'm trying to let her know, like, hey, this is something we can do together. If you want to go, I'll take you. You know, I'll, you know, it doesn't matter what I have planned. If you want to go, we'll go. So it seems like every year she gets a little more into it. She seems to be a little more into the deer hunting over the turkey, a little more patient with it. She heard I was going elk hunting this year, and last time I went elk hunting, she actually called me up on the mountain. I saw her calling. I was like, oh, he said, hey, honey. And she goes, Dad, next time you go elk hunting, can I come with you?
So cool.
And I was like, yeah, you can. You know, of course you can.
Yeah.
So, So this year, you know, she said the same thing. It's in reality, it's a little, probably a little more than she could take on where I'm hunting. It's some pretty, you know, steep country, but the fact that she wants to do that, I'm going to make it a point to like maybe start with an antelope hunt, you know, do something like that. She's already into the whitetail, but yeah, I hope it's something we do together for a lifetime. And if it's not, it's okay. I'm not going to push it on her, but
perfect.
She takes interest in it. And I think part of me thinks it's more, she just like spending time with me,
right?
You know, which is totally fine with me too. Yeah. So. But we'll see, you know, we'll see how that all pans out. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome, man. Very exciting. Okay.
The rapid fire gauntlet by Mark.
Going to hammer down. Favorite day to hunt deer and why? If you're going to pick one, you're like, oh, man, if you give me one day, this is the day I'm going to go hunt deer. And it doesn't have to be because it was a big buck, just because, like, that's just a good day.
Yeah. I would probably say opening day always seems to be my favorite. I'm usually on something good because I spend a lot of time in those weeks leading up to try to narrow down a specific deer. Opening day I love, but I will say for whatever reason, November 6th, I've killed four mature bucks on November 6th. Seems to be my lucky day, including that Iowa buck that we were talking about. So November 6th, opening day.
Couldn't agree more with the opening day thing.
That's favorite terrain to hunt. You've hunted a variety of terrains, you know, open country, hill country, marsh bucks, whatever. What's your favorite terrain to hunt deer?
I'm gonna say a tie between the Western Plains and hill country.
Okay.
Yeah, really liking those. I've hunted a lot of like the marshes and swamps and some ag, and that was kind of what I grew up cutting my teeth hunting on, all that stuff. I love it.
Sure.
But I want more of that other stuff because it's just what we don't have around home.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
cool.
Sure. All right, last one. This was a new one, Eric.
Ooh.
And maybe this is a hard one or an easy one. I don't know. Coolest thing you've seen a deer do in the deer woods. Deer do weird stuff sometimes.
It's a good one.
Okay, I got a good one. This was on a public marsh in Michigan. It was actually a buck I was after. And I was sitting up in this spot overlooking this giant marsh. And in this, it was like a cattail marsh with some ponds and some kind of creek drainages kind of connecting the two. But it was, there's in this marsh, it was like, I would say like knee high, kind of like marshy grass, maybe waist high. Like you could see deer out there. And then there were these pockets, these like swaths of cattails, you know, like a big swath here, a small swath here, a pocket of cover here. And each of those spots potentially had doe bedding in it. Okay. So there was like does that were bedded out there and, you know, sometimes they'd be here and here and here. Well, this was November 5th. And I saw this buck like emerge like way out in the marsh, like, you know, half mile away. And I'm like, wow, that's a big deer, you know? And all of a sudden he just starts trotting and he starts coming through this marsh and he goes downwind of this swath, downwind of this swath, downwind of this, downwind of this. And it within like a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes, he had scent checked that whole marsh. And the way he did it was so efficient. You know, he stayed away from any trees where potentially a hunter could be, including me. And I was in a good spot too. He kind of came by, but he didn't come within bow range, but he checked every little swath of cover that could potentially hold deer. And he scent checked it. And he did that whole marsh in like late morning. It was like 10:30, 11 o'clock, probably when every other hunter was gone. Yeah. And he scent checked them like that. And I was like, wow, yeah. Like that deer literally put himself in no danger. You know, he didn't go by a single tree. And he did exactly what he needed to do. You know, I thought that was so cool. And it was just, I learned a lot, you know, just by watching that. It was like, they don't put them in a high pressured area like that. They don't put themselves in danger very often. Like they will, he was obviously moving and it was bow season, but it was during the rut. His mind is on one thing, but he didn't take his mind off survival.
Yeah.
You know, now had he busted a doe out of there and then that doe takes off. Yeah, maybe he runs by 100.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But it was just so cool, man. It was so neat and so efficient the way he did that. And I was like, wow, if you weren't sitting where I was, you wouldn't even know that happened.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. That is super cool.
Very cool.
Man, you see something like, God, you guys are good.
How do you get them? You're good. You know? Yeah, that is awesome.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to come out here and visit with us and chat about deer hunting. I know we opened this up with killing more bucks in less time. Frankly, I was looking for a magic bullet, but it sounds like you're still putting in a ton of work. Yep. And you know, a lot of that time was on the front end of your early, you know, early stages of whitetail hunting, but you're still doing a lot of scouting and things like that.
Yep.
But all leading up to being really, really efficient when you are hitting the woods, and I think that's a really important thing to point
out
here. So
that's right,
Eric. We'll keep searching for our guest that can tell us how to do this without putting in the work. I don't think we'll ever find it.
I don't think it exists.
All right, thanks everybody again, Andy. Thank you again.
Yep.
Take care. We'll see you on the next one.
Thanks, guys.
All right, that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Vortex Nation podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button, give us a review, or leave a comment. We want to hear what you have to say. If you have a question or topic suggestion, let us know that as well via the Vortex Nation podcast YouTube page or any of Vortex's social platforms. That helps us cover exactly what you want to hear so we can provide the best information to help you with your hunting, shooting, and related activities, and ultimately enjoy them to their fullest potential. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you on the next one.